Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. And joining me in the studio is Catherine Kramer, who is an actress, singer, journalist, and producer who founded Cat Kramer's Films That Changed the World, a showcase motion pictures to showcase motion pictures that raise awareness about important social issues. And in doing so, she's following in the footsteps of her late father, the legendary producer-director Stanley Kramer, who was known for taking artistic and financial chances by making films about controversial subjects and whose films include such classics as High Noon, On the Beach, and Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. And also joining us in a moment here is by phone is Lily Tomlin, the multi-award-winning actress, comedian, writer, and producer who has been a major force in American comedy. And she has, of course, started out in Laugh-In, and she's appeared in a number of extraordinary films such as Nashville and 9 to 5 and I Heart Huckabees. And Catherine Kramer, welcome to Background Briefing. It's good to see you.
I'm happy to be here. It's great.
And tell me about how you and Lily are hosting this event tomorrow. I believe it's the North American premiere of this new film, Fallout. So how did you all come together? And we'll get into the film, but give us a sense of what you're putting on here.
Well, when I first started Cat Kramer's Films That Changed the World, like you said before, I was following in my father's footsteps, which I still continue to do. And the third installment of the series was a film called Elephants and Man, A Litany of Tragedy. And as you know, Lily is very involved with animal issues and particularly elephants in captivity. And that was the subject of the film and the issues that we were focusing on. And so Lily hosted that event and was so amazing. She was on the panel. She was one of the speakers. And the next film I had after that was about bullying, LGBT bullying in schools and school violence, and Lily happened to have narrated that film, and that's called Teach Your Children Well. It's a very powerful documentary. That was the fourth installment. And again, I was so lucky to have Lily's involvement to host that and also appear and speak and join the panel. So here we are on the fifth anniversary. This is the fifth installment in my fifth anniversary of Cat Kramer's Films That Changed the World. And this film, Fallout, which is very timely. It's an Australian film, as I'm sure you know, and it's all about nuclear issues and primarily, though, about my father, Stanley Kramer, making On the Beach in Australia and taking Neville Shute's novel. And Dr. Helen Caldicott is a leading voice in nuclear issues. She's also in the film, and On the Beach is what set her on her course and her path, her life's path, her life work. And Lily is a good friend of Helen's, so this brings us all back together. I mean, Lily and I have done KPFK a couple of times here in the studio, and I'm just so honored that she's introducing Helen tomorrow night and joining the panel again. So it's really, it's so synchronistic that this is the third premiere that we've had, and having Dr. Caldicott be the keynote speaker, I couldn't be more thrilled and honored.
But so you're trying to shape these films around political themes, and in a way, because one of the things I've noticed, I'm sure you have too, is how so many great documentaries are coming out now. It used to be the Academy; all the documentaries are about the Holocaust, and they were boring. But now they're taking on all kinds of political issues. And in many ways, I suspect this has a lot to do with our collective failure of journalism, because the newspapers are running, you know, they call it the dead tree business. They're running out of business. They're cutting off their and cutting back their investments in investigative journalism, et cetera, et cetera. So it seems to me that the movies, and particularly the documentary part of the movies, have really become – they filled the void in many ways. And it's not very many movies. You know, what was it, the famous adage from Samuel Goldman? If you want to send a message
– call Western Union.
Call Western Union. That was the way Hollywood was ruled, right?
It's true, because my father made movies all with a message, all social issues, and he didn't even want that title of message filmmaker. He just wanted to tell those stories and – you know, have everyone take a look at taboo subjects in our society. And that's really what these documentaries are doing today. And that is why I primarily screen documentaries. That's pretty much, except for the very first one I did, that is what I've always done and what I continue to do. And you're right, the film, you know, you can pick a certain film that has an issue or just what you want to explore an issue, and you have to find the right film for that issue. Well, there's so many powerful and enlightening documentaries, I've never had a problem finding the right film for the issue. And this happens to be, you know, unfortunate as it is, the topic that we really need to focus on just over the last couple of days. with Fukushima and the talks in Iran and everything that's going on. And this film is already released in Australia. It's gotten rave reviews. My mother, Karen Sharp Kramer, appears in it. Donna Anderson, who was in On the Beach, my father discovered her. Neville Shute's daughter, Heather Mayfield. They're all going to be on the panel tomorrow night with a lot of other experts. And so I think that we're going to have a chance to talk about the fallout, the actual fallout that we're dealing with, and also the fallout between the creative voices with the film being Neville Shute and Stanley Kramer.
Well, of course, Catherine Kramer, your father made films in an era when he really was controversial, and he was dealing in a I have a millennial daughter, and the millennials are post race and post gender. I mean, they've gotten all over those hang-ups that have afflicted these previous generations. And your father was making movies during the afflicted generations, in effect.
He was the only one, I have to say, that was willing to take those chances. There may have been other filmmakers exploring the issues, but he always got the biggest stars and the greatest actors to appear in his films. Right. And a lot of times, you know, this is his centennial this year. He actually would have been 100. So I can't think of a better marriage with my screening series, and it's my way of contributing to a centennial. And, you know, just watching On the Beach the other night, we had a screening of it just a couple months ago. It's just the power of the film.
Talk about a galaxy of stars. Yeah. Gregory Peck, Fred Astaire, Ava Gardner. Who else?
Anthony Perkins. And Donna Anderson.
Right.
Yeah.
And it was, of course, shot in Melbourne, which nowadays is actually quite an interesting city, but in those days, as Ava Gardner said, which it riled up the Australian press, this is a perfect place to make a movie about the end of the world.
That's all in Fallout, too. And you see the movie that's quoted in there.
And does the film in any way, maybe it's a digression, did it deal with Frank Sinatra showing up there on the set?
No, but I've heard
that's
all
an
those
hilarious
stories.
Story that he couldn't get on the set, and he came all that way in the days of before the jet aircraft, you know.
Yes.
And he hated Australia as a result, and he never went back. And then when he finally went back, he did a press conference at the airport, and the Australian journalists are a little more aggressive than they are here. And a couple of the women journalists asked him questions which upset him. And he said something to the effect that, you know, you women are nothing but a bunch of whores or something like that. And the entire country shut down because they have powerful unions there. And nobody would put gas in Frank Sinatra's plane. Nobody would pick up his bags at the hotel until he apologized to the women of Australia.
That's
and it
great.
Was all led by the head of the trade unions, who ended up becoming the prime minister, a guy called Bob Hawke. So it was the only time that Frank Sinatra in his life actually had to apologize, because, you know, his whole idea was, I did it my way, you know. So there's that's a little bit of a tangent. But so tell me about why, you know, I remember from the film, one of the most, just from somebody that's interested in filmmaking itself, one of the more extraordinary scenes that I remember is towards the end of the movie, is when Gregory Peck is the commander of the submarine, surfaces in San Francisco Bay, and the entire city is dead because everybody on continental America has died. And the premise of the movie is that Melbourne, Australia, is the last piece of on the planet where people can still live before the fallout gets them.
Yeah, that was also in the book as well, I believe. And every time that I see it or anyone sees it, they just fall silent. And, you know, the slogan at the end, or the lament at the end, there is still time, brother. And when you look at that now, you think, you know, we really haven't learned that much. And that's the whole focus of my screening series is, yes, my father's films changed laws. And yes, a lot of the films that I'm screening now, or that are out there today, the documentaries especially, have changed things, made changes, and have changed laws too. But every so many years, a new generation forgets that, and they have to be reminded again. You know, it's just like with the Holocaust. I was at a function the other night, and they were telling us that anti-Semitism is on the rise again in Europe. And, you know, when you think that my father made Judgment at Nuremberg, that just that movie alone, and then, you know, Spielberg made Schindler's List, you look at films like that, and just educating you know, new generations about the Holocaust to think that it would be starting up again, because unless we remind everybody all the time, they'll just keep going back to their old ways. And we have Rick O'Berry coming, you know, tomorrow night, who is the subject of the film The Cove.
The Cove. I remember. I interviewed him, yeah.
And I screened that. Film. I screened that for the series. And that was one of the best ones I did, because I invited Academy members who had not seen the film. They were afraid to look at the dolphin slaughter. And when they saw the film, you know, they went and voted for it, I have to say, that night. I couldn't believe they were afraid to see it. It was the hot film that everyone was talking about. We had a 5-year-old activist, and he said, if I can see it, the adults can see it. But he is going back to Tai Chi. They're still slaughtering the dolphins. You know, it stopped for a while, but after the movie won the Academy Award, but they're starting up again. The minute that they think that people have forgotten, they'll go back. So, but I can't think of an issue bigger than the end of the world. Can you?
Well, it hasn't happened, but it sure felt like it was going to happen for many decades. Yeah. And I suppose in a converse way, you can argue that the fact that the Cold War ended, and even though the weapons are still there, there's been psychological disarmament. There may not be physical disarmament, but it's highly unlikely that any of the nuclear states, except perhaps Pakistan and India, will use their weapons. They'd still have them, and so there's a lot of work to do in terms of disarmament. There's no two ways about it. But the fact that what seemed so intractable, that seemed so inevitable, particularly during the Reagan administration when I worked on the nuclear freeze and other issues, it did seem like that it was going to happen eventually. And I worked at Los Alamos, as a matter of fact, on a project on the future of deterrence, because at some point or other, Murphy's Law comes into play, you know. Mm-hmm. And you kept building more weapons, and the more weapons you built on both sides, the less secure you became. So they were trapped, and that whole Gordian knot was broken by Reagan and Gorbachev. So the fact that we as a species can actually change, I think, is also hopeful. And you know, also it's also worth mentioning that we as a species also are capable of creating these monstrous weapons and letting them get out of control. And your father made that movie when things couldn't have been more bleak, right? That was before – was that before the Cuba crisis?
Well, 1959.
Yes, it was.
It was before.
Three years before the Cuba crisis. And that was at the height of paranoia about the Russians are coming.
And that was also Fred Astaire making his dramatic debut. You know, I mean, people – you know, he had to cast – actors that the audience could relate to, because the subjects were so bleak and people didn't really want to face these issues. So by having Ava Gardner or Gregory Peck, they could relate better to what the characters were going through.
Right.
So if anyone ever criticized him, you know, why didn't he use up-and-comers? He did with Donna Anderson in her role, but he had to have, you know, first of all, to get the film made that still exists today, you had to have pretty big stars just to get the movie made. But you know, he was very specific about who he wanted, and you'll see in Fallout, it goes through the background of all that.
Right. But if he made that film in 59, it came out in 59, in other words, that was the end of Eisenhower. Kennedy hadn't even come in. And Kennedy, of course, I mean, Eisenhower tried to end the Cold War, and he almost had a deal on the table with Khrushchev, who visited here. Remember, he wanted to go to Disneyland, right? And that was all torpedoed by the U-2 incident.
I think some of that's touched on, you know,
in which
you have to see the film.
I have to see the film, of course.
I really want you to see it.
I do.
You'll come tomorrow.
I will. But I know from my research on the Eisenhower administration how close they came to a deal. And then the U-2 thing blew that out of the water. So I'm trying to get a sense of where the public was at when that film came out, your father's film came out. It was before Kennedy, and Kennedy there was a sense of a breath of fresh air. And no sooner had he got into office than there was the Bay of Pigs, and then there was the Cuba crisis. And then he made that extraordinary speech at American University.
Well, I found out my father's on the beach helped start the disarmament talks at the U.N., You knew about that, right?
No, I was about to suggest that he was, you know, making this film in an environment, you know, that was pretty bleak. So tell us about how that happened and how much he influenced the environment.
Well, I know a little bit about it, but tomorrow night, the experts on that subject would probably be my mother and Donna Anderson. Mm-hmm. And they're going to definitely be touching upon that. But I do know that got, you know, the UN to start the disarmament talks, and he premiered it, you know, in many different countries in one night. I think that was the first of its kind to happen like that. Mm-hmm. And that's all in fallout. The interesting thing about this film is that it doesn't just touch on the bomb and the origins of it. And, you know, it spends a lot of time on the history of that, sure, in the beginning. And it paints the picture of what we're dealing with now. So it brings it up to date and with everybody's voice, like Helen and Gideon Haig, who's interviewed in there. There's, you know, you'll see it. And Philip Davey, who did When Hollywood Came to Melbourne, he wrote the book about it. Mm-hmm. But it spends a lot of time on just Neville Shute himself moving to Australia from Great Britain and writing on the beach, and then, you know, the battles he had with my father on how the movie should be made. And a great deal of the last half of the film focuses on that. So it really gives audiences a chance to focus on not only the issues and see, you know, we were dealing with it back then, we're still dealing with it now, but it's also a slice of film history and the classic sense. So that's what's so great about it.
Well, tell me, though, there's a euphemism here in Hollywood called creative differences. So tell me about the creative differences that the novelist Neville Shute, who did A Town Like Alice and some classic books, many of which were made into movies. What was the fights that he had with your father?
Well,
over
that's
on the
all
beach?
Documented in the film. I know he did.
But just give us a tiny taste of what was the...
He disagreed so much with, you know, the love story part of it. And I think in the book that was not touched upon at all.
Well, if the world's going to end,
but
what
yes,
are you supposed
exactly.
to do?
I mean, he wanted to stick just to the book, which was bone-chilling when,
right.
you know, I mean, that's even what Helen said when she first read it. And then seeing the film, that has more humanity by not
right.
having it stick exactly to the book. You have to have romance and love
right.
if the world is ending, you know. It's,
sure.
That's what you would do is grab onto somebody, right?
Right.
That's what I think the main fight was between them was about them consummating their love affair, you know, having
yeah.
a love affair and actually
right.
you know, having that be a big part of the story. But nobody could relate to it otherwise, especially not in 1959.
Right.
But I don't know if a filmmaker and a writer or one of the directors and the writers, the novelists, they always argue. I mean, it's mm-hmm. rare to find a
it's
meeting
true.
Of the minds there.
So. Well, writers are particularly protective of their babies, you know. But
yes.
in this case, it feels like, from what you've told me, that your father made the right call in the sense that it connected the idea that these are the last people on the planet, you know, and death is encroaching.
And the use of Waltzing Matilda in there really, you know, that's just so haunting.
Yes.
Some of the scenes where that song is, I can never forget those images, and what the music just stays with you. And I think it really makes you feel that you're there too, and that, you know, it's the end of time, and it just seems contemporary to me.
So this what's going to happen with this film that you're premiering tomorrow then, Fallout? It's a documentary film, right?
Yes.
About the making of your father's film and its political impact. But it also, doesn't it have echoes of what's happening today with Fukushima? We don't even know what the fallout from Fukushima is and where it is and how much it's happening. And we know it's affecting the West Coast here in the United States.
Well, there was a special the other night on ABC where they said, you know, be careful that it's coming here. We may have to evacuate. I was with some people the other night that think that it's already here on the West Coast. And they're selling their home in Santa Barbara. They say a lot of people are selling their homes in Malibu, I guess because they think of...
Really?
I think it's... Some people think that we've been lied to and that it's already here. So it's a bleak thought, but it's on everybody's minds for sure.
Well, you know, I talked to some people that were dealing with the sailors who were affected on the USS Ronald Reagan and big nuclear aircraft carrier. And believe it or not, the U.S. Navy, in a relief effort, parked that big boat right next to Fukushima within days of the accident. And it has to desalinate its water through its nuclear reactors. So it's sucking in all this seawater that's contaminated by radiation, and all the sailors on that ship were showering and drinking that water. And then it was the sailor who had to take the flag from the top of the mast every day as they change the flags or whatever they do in the ritual. And there was so much radiation on that flag that he set off the Geiger counters. And then but the idea that the U.S. Navy sent a ship in there and these brain dead officers weren't thinking about all of that you know, radioactive water that was, because all they, what they had to do was they had to pump seawater to keep the cores cool, or, you know, they were melting down, literally melting down. They had to keep throwing all this water on them to cool them, and all that water went back into the ocean. So, I mean, it's a horrible story. So I don't believe that we know a fraction of what the consequences of Fukushima are.
No, I don't think we do either.
Well, we have to see fallout, right?
Yes, you better come see it.
I'm under orders here. Okay, we have to wrap up now. I thank you so much, Catherine Kramer, for joining us here. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
And Lily, who didn't she, show, but that's show business.
She was calling. Did she? Okay.
Well. No, whatever. And again, I've been speaking with Catherine Kramer, actress, singer, journalist, and producer who founded Kat Kramer's Films That Changed the World. Tomorrow, they are showcasing the North American premiere of a new documentary feature, Fallout. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.